Welcome to the Cycling Podcast, an hour build-up to the 2026 Tour de France, rolling through a fair few cerebral vertical meters with me, Graham Wilgos, is the king of the grey matter mountains of not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Wow, we've gone intellectual already. We're setting the bar high here, Graham.
It's almost getting the intellectual out the way before we descend into, well, the opposite of intellectual.
The infantile and puerile. No, we'll try and keep it sensible, won't we, this week, Graham? The Tour de France is looming. We've had three incredible days of racing at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. A big ping for getting that right first time. No mention of the Dauphiné, the now defunct name, even though everything is screaming in my head that, no, it's a Dauphiné, it's a Dauphiné, it's a Dauphiné. But no, we're respecting the name of the race as it currently is. And this is Attitude Camp. I don't know what the equivalent of an Everest attempt in attitude is, but considering Paul Sexas and his preparation for the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes was a mammoth training camp in Sierra Nevada. He spent 16 days there, climbed the equivalent of Everest 5.5 times almost. That's, what was it, 1.81 kilometres in altitude gained, I think that was. Is that right? That doesn't sound enough.
It doesn't sound enough. You usually accuse me of being stato. While you check that, my congratulations, first of all, on, I was going to call it the prestigious stage race formerly known as the Dauphiné, but Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, so that we're both one for one there, or I think you were two for two on your mentions.
I have got the stat now. It was 47,749 metres of climbing and 1,881 kilometres of riding. In 16 days.
That is huge.
That's a lot of work, isn't it?
It is. And so he's clearly building up for a big summer. We're only 3 and a bit weeks out from the Grand Depart in Barcelona. We're recording on Wednesday morning, the day before the World Cup begins. Already mentioned Paul Sexas a couple of times there too. I mean, I was wondering, I think Rob Hatch mentioned this on commentary, at the Not Dauphiné yesterday. Paul Sexas must be, or might be, hoping that France do well in the World Cup, and then a little bit of the pressure is off him. That said, the way he's talking, not necessarily the way he's riding, and we'll obviously get into this, it's not gone as we thought it might, because he was widely considered as the pre-race favourite for the overall. For the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. And he's currently, without any sort of spoiler alerts, because we're going to take it, we're going to take the race apart, what we've seen so far, stages 1 to 3, yesterday's team time trial. Sexas currently sits at 12th on GC, exactly a minute down, on the yellow jersey. And the yellow jersey, should we get into stage one, is currently, as the riders roll out from where they're rolling out.
Le Puy-en-Velay. Graham, yeah.
This morning, Wednesday morning, is Alex Baudin of EF Education Easy Post, and it's been sort of looking back at the route. It's been a breakaway route those first two stages, and so EF must have been licking their lips, and it bodes well for them and what they can do. Particularly when you think about their performance last year as stage hunters at the Tour, it bodes well for them for this summer, for July.
Yeah, let's delve deeply into the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes in the next part. But in summary, it's been three fantastic days of racing so far. The route's been beautiful to look at, for one thing. Reminds me of watching the Tour de France sort of 30, 40 years ago. One of the great beauties of this race in this region is it's big enough to be really important. We've got some great riders here. We've got probably two-thirds of the Tour de France field getting ready for the Tour this week. But the race is small enough that they can take it onto some smaller roads. Not always, but some of the roads they've been on have been absolutely beautiful. And it just conjures up those kind of, I guess, the bucolic memories of my childhood July is watching the Tour de France on TV and just seeing once again how beautiful France is. And a little bit of that gets lost sometimes because of the size and scale of the Tour de France, the following caravan, the crowds being that much bigger. So they have to be a bit more considerate about avoiding the smaller country roads that we've been treated to for much of this week so far. It's been a glorious watch, both from the aesthetic but also the intrigue of the racing. And we'll get stuck right into that after this short break.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel any time. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
So, Lionel, the Not Dauphiné, the Tour Auvergne Rhône Alpes. We set it up, as many did, as many thought it would be, as a test of Paul Sexas's Tour de France credentials, even if it was in the absence of Tadej Pogacar, Jonas Vingegaard, Florian Lipowitz, Remco Evenepoel. That was the headline, as I say, for most. But the race hasn't shaped up that way. And it was very much a case, or it seems very much a case, of the best laid plans to this point.
Yeah, well, not the ideal start for decathlon, was it? Because Matthew Riccitello there, American rider, very good climber, a key helper for Sexas in the hillier stages. He failed to finish stage one. He was dropped very early, still with 115Ks to go, and abandoned with 80K to go. Stomach upset, rumoured, reported to be food poisoning. My first thought was, I hope they haven't all had to fish. Too far from the sea.
I always wonder when you hear the food poisoning excuse or reason. I always wonder, is that just another way of just saying, look, he wasn't on it today and he wasn't ready for a reason that we're not willing to disclose, and yeah, therefore we're just going to give you the food poisoning headline and move on.
But don't worry, it's not a stomach bug that's going to rip through the team, which I think was my first concern. Paul Sexas seemed to be fine. When he got to the finish, he got into the bus very quickly, and people were reading quite a lot into that on social media. But I mean, knowing the scale of the race, you know, it's not as big and as grand as the Tour de France. There's nothing else to do when you get back to the bus. It's literally just lean your bike against the outside of the bus and hop on board. So, and we've seen he's in good enough shape. But yeah, not the ideal start for decathlon. But, you know, stage racing throws these curveballs at teams and riders, and it's all about adapting, ripping up those best laid plans at sometimes no notice. So a good dress rehearsal. If decathlon wanted to look for the silver lining on that particular cloud, that would be it. They are now having to adapt. And of course, the biggest handicap for them, the biggest setback for them, was that they would be down to just six starters for the team time trial. So a significant loss. But they rolled with it and they had a pretty good day. But overall, it was a fantastic stage. Looked brilliant, as I said, but it was also, you know, the way the roads went, the where the hills were positioned, it led to a really great day's racing and a very suspenseful finish, because with about an hour to go, the question was, would anyone from the breakaway, the early breakaway, stay away? And it was hanging in the balance. At one point, the gap didn't look like it would be anything like enough. But as you said earlier, Graham, Alex Baudin, who'd been in that early break of initially nine riders for EF Education First, he finished it off. Biggest win of his career after 124 kilometres or so out in front.
Five categorised climbs in stage one. So it was no small feat, but it really looked like an EF Education first stage, didn't it? And especially from what we saw from them at the tour last summer, bodes very, very well for what they might be able to do this time around in July. But Bodan said, the stars aligned for me today. But I mean, yes, there was a bit of that, but they also worked to make that happen. Mm. And, you know, 25K solo break to the end, that's a lot of stars aligning, and you have to do an awful lot of the grunt work yourself to make that happen.
Well, yeah, because he was sort of, there were points where he was in a bit of difficulty and he just had to bide his time a little. And, you know, then there were points where the break was splitting down. I mean, the fact that EF Education, Easy Post got two riders into that early break because he was joined by Alistair McKellar as well. There was Zimmerman of Lotto Antimarché in there, Garcia Pierna of Movistar, Vescher of Total Energies, and George Bennett of NSN were initially in there. Brat Afonso of Groupama was another rider who was prominent. He got himself up there as well. And so there were a lot of good climbing legs in there. So it was a win that Bodan really had to go out and grab. Because in that final phase of the race, when the gap over the peloton, or kind of what was left of the peloton, was down to about a minute and 10, a minute and 15 seconds, and it was all starting to kick off behind, Visma Lisa Bike were setting a pretty strong pace with Bruno Armirai. There were attacks here and there as well. Kevin Vermaak of UAE Team Emirates went off the front of the bunch. And, you know, there was even with that counter move, you know, he wasn't close enough to getting up to the front. But there was a point where he was almost caught by the GC group and then stretched away again. And so that gave, you know, the impression that, oh, it's a bit of an accordion finish, this. It could all, you know, stretch out or come back together. So full credit to Alex Bodan, winning in his home region as well. So a significant victory for him, and a big one for EF Education. And surprising, because we both commented on this when we were communicating on WhatsApp, that team's first stage victory in the Dauphiné, as was. That, which surprised me, because it feels like a race that they've done well in. They won...
Well, they've won it twice, haven't they?
Yeah, Andrew Talansky. And
yeah, Talansky famously catching or overhauling Contador's seemingly safe lead in 2014. I was actually at that race, and it was sort of close quarters to see Talansky just kind of, well, collapse onto his handlebars at the end, and just, you know, tears of disbelief. But that was sort of put down to Contador's taking his eye off the ball. And I never thought Talansky was given the credit he deserved for that one. But Danny Martinez in recent memory, I want to say 2020, but it might have been 2021. For their second win, but two overall wins without having won a stage.
Yeah, and well, you mentioned Danny Martinez. I mean, he was one of the riders kind of yo-yoing off the back of the GC group at one point. He got dropped, then got back on, then got dropped again. I think that indicated, you know, these stages, it was relatively short, it's hilly, a lot of climbing, and for a lot of riders, the first race back, if you like, after either a training block or a bit of a rest and reset as they build up to the Tour de France. And so really interesting to see who responded well and who responded less well. Significantly, João Almeida of UAE Team Emirates had already said he's not in good enough shape to ride the Tour de France. So he's taken himself out of selection for the Tour de France, won't be part of Tadej Pogacar's lineup there. Presumably will refocus on the Vuelta, because otherwise it's starting to look like a bit of a dot ball season for him, having had a very difficult start to the year. He was dropped very early from the peloton, really surprising. Other riders dropped. Wout van Aert, who is, you know, he's just getting going again, isn't he, in the build-up to the Tour de France.
After his Paris-Roubaix celebrations.
Understandable. Fair enough.
He lost 25 minutes plus, didn't he, in the end?
But I don't think too much of a panic. I mean, it looks like a kind of controlled week. We'll probably talk about his contribution in the team time trial as well. But Stefan Bissiger as well, perhaps with an eye on the team time trial, he decided to take it a little bit easier. The one that surprised me, I suppose, was Net Company Ineos Dorian Godon, because I said last week this race looks absolutely set up for Godon. You know, he could win sort of three or four stages, but he was off the back. And then a rider who suffered some real misfortune. Jordan Zegat, 10th in the Tour de France last year. He had a flat tire right before the Côte de Russey climb and then faced a difficult and fruitless chase. So it was a really entertaining day, lots and lots going on.
And a good day for Netcompany Ineos as well, for their dual-pronged attack of Kevin Vauquelin and Oscar Onley, who took a little bit of time on their rivals, on their GC rivals, including Isaac Del Toro. So they came in 35 seconds down, Onley and 32 seconds down, Onley and Vauquelin, with Isaac Del Toro coming in 44 seconds down, and the rest after that. So Ineos's week started very well. We'll come to their time trial, team time trial performance. Should we move on to stage two?
Well,
is there any other business from
stage
one?
Well, just wanted to pick up on that. You know, Onley and Vauquelin, yeah, they were riding very much kind of two-up style, weren't they? Both close to each other, perhaps even marking each other, making sure that one didn't go anywhere without the other. And maybe that's the theme that will develop over the rest of the week. But yeah, with Godon out of the picture, that gave Onley and Vauquelin the license to make that little move towards the end. It was only in the last 5 kilometres or so, wasn't it? But they gained a little bit of time. And considering there's no time bonuses in the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes this year, it's got to be won on the road. And so, you know, every second at that point did count. And to just eke out 12 seconds over Del Toro, Ayuso, Sexas, and the rest. A very good performance by Vauquelin and Onley, more than making up for the fact that Godon was not up there to contest for the stage win. The time losses, Almeida lost 24 minutes in the end, so completely out of the picture. Wonder whether he'll make it to the finish of this race. It's looking perhaps doubtful. But some other riders that lost time, Emmanuel Buchmann, Tobias Halland, Johannesson, and Andreas Kron lost almost 3 minutes. Ben Healy lost 2.5. Danny Martinez did a little bit better, but you know, for a former winner, he's not going to be doing that again. But the GC group really narrowed down on day one, didn't it? You can pick the winner already from probably 8 or 10 riders after stage one.
With Healy and Van Aert, you sort of wonder whether they're setting themselves up for a breakaway win later this week before we get to the real high mountains.
The Tour de France is the big goal for them, isn't it? I mean, we're getting really deep into this race because it's on now and it's big name riders all racing one another. But let's not get too carried away. It doesn't mean the world at this point. You know, Wout van Aert isn't going to be losing too much sleep. As long as they say the sensations are good, I'm sure if everything's moving in the right direction, he'll be ready for Barcelona, no doubt.
So another man with good sensations was Uno X Mobility's Charmig man. Or the Pedaleur de Charmig, as I said to you. Sorry to take your quip.
This Charmig man. Well, that might be up for debate, actually, because he got a yellow card, didn't he? We'll talk about that in a mo. But yeah, Uno X rider was aggressive from the start. I mean, this was a real brute of a day, wasn't it? 234 kilometres.
The longest. Da-da, you go along the longest stage. Here, who's going to say it?
Was it? Well, it's for a long, long time
for more than 20 years. The longest stage for more than 20 years. 234.3 Ks was the route. And it was another one for the breakaway, for the strongest man won.
Yeah, I do wonder, do they need a stage of this length in terms of the kind of TV spectacle? It was once again nice to look at, but we only got to see the final 2 hours because that's how much of the race is made available by the host broadcaster. So we saw enough of it. I don't get the impression we missed anything by not seeing the preceding sort of 3.5 hours. But I thought this during the Giro, the big stage to Blockhouse, which was even longer, I think. I don't know whether this really kind of fits with the intense explosive racing. We saw a much more controlled day. The break was away. They got their 5.5 or so minutes. They were kept at, you know, pretty much that gap for most of the day. And really, what were they doing? They were kind of just pedaling along for longer than was necessary. But, you know, if you're only watching 2 hours of it on TV, does it really make any difference? I would suggest probably not. The 2 hours we got to watch was entertaining to see. It was wet and cold at one point, and then it brightened up as they got towards the finish. And as you say, Anton Charmig of Uno X got in that early break. Initially, it was a move of six or seven riders, and then there was a counter move of a few more that went across. We saw Jegat get up there trying to make amends for the previous day. We saw Brad Afonso up there again. But it was a ride by Charmig when they came down to the sort of jagged climbs at the end. He was in a position where he was behind Brad Afonso, Garcia Piena and Van Mechelen, and then got himself up, and then he made that big move on the final sort of metres of the last climb, and then time trialled to the finish. A really impressive, strong ride for someone we know is a good rider, but, you know, this, again, is a kind of career-defining win at this stage.
His previous best was a stage of the Tour of Oman in 2022 for Anton Charmig, and at 28 years old, he really felt like now is the time. This week was the time. He's got a few second places on his palmares, but, you know, nothing really of note. So yeah, huge win for him and for Uno X Mobility.
Yeah, they're getting good at this, aren't they? They've pulled off a few victories. They're becoming that team that identifies specific days, it seems. Easy to say in hindsight, isn't it? Because we sort of always do. But, you know, the day that Frederik de Vincenis won in the Giro, you know, getting in that break of four and then dashing the hopes of the three riders from the Italian wildcard teams at the finish. You know, contradicting myself a bit here, because that was the most unlikely of wins. I mean, they defied all the sprinters in Milan, didn't they? And stayed away. But Uno X are placing riders in breaks where they think they've got a good chance. And the course, with all of that climbing and the distance as well, it needed to be a rider that would be strong enough to stay away all day, able to hang in on the against better climbers at key points, and then pick his moment perfectly. And he did that, and then rode extremely strongly to the finish. And he got his yellow card for a non-compliant riding position. The jury report actually said he was penalised for failing to comply with the instructions of the race commissaire. So a yellow card, he's basically on a warning. If he gets another yellow card in this race, he would be disqualified and then would be suspended for a period and then would be allowed to race again. Now we understand that it was because he was resting his forearms on the handlebars. Now, this wasn't the kind of banned puppy paws position. It didn't seem to me, anyway, from the footage. I went back and watched a bit of that descent where he was trying to get a bit of a more comfortable and more aero position.
You were the VAR.
I was the VAR. He was actually gripping the hoods of the brake levers, right? But he did have his forearms on the handlebars. And so it looked a little bit of a harsh one, because the whole point of the banning of the puppy paws position, which was banned in 2021, along with several other positions that are deemed to be unsafe, such as hanging over the back of the saddle or sitting on the top tube, for good reason. Not safe, you're not fully in control of the bike. Mm-hmm. Hanging your hands over the handlebars and not gripping anything, you know, hit a bump in the road and it could be a really nasty crash. So it's a rule for good reason. But he was holding onto the hoods, it seemed to me. You know, I'm only seeing the TV footage, so the commissaires have obviously seen enough to give him the warning and ask him not to do it. He presumably didn't comply, got the yellow card. But then Uno X have sent photos to the jury, apparently, of Pogacar, Vingegaard and Remco Evenepoel all adopting a similar position. Now, when it comes to these rules, you know, I don't think justice works by saying, well, these guys got away with it, so we shouldn't be penalised. It's the luck of the draw. If you break the rule and you're spotted, you get penalised. That's just hard cheese. You've got no defence, really.
But you are allowed to be frustrated by that lack of consistency.
Of course.
In the way the rules are applied.
Of course, yes. And, you know, look, it didn't cost him the stage win. The yellow card system operates to kind of have a bit of leeway. You know, it wasn't a flat dismissal, a disqualification. I mean, that would have been very harsh. We'll perhaps do a little bit of a rules review. We'll go to the VAR room at the end of the episode, because this chimes with a few rules that the UCI have clarified that will come on stream a bit later on. And also a Dutch rider, Jan Willem van Schip, who's got a real reputation for, he's the sort of Roy Keane of cycling. Was Roy Keane the player that got sent off the most in football? But
Feels like it, doesn't it?
Yeah, Van Schip has been disqualified from more races than I've had hot dinners for, bending and perhaps even breaking the rules when it comes to his position on the bike. But it gets a little dry, so we'll do that at the end of the episode.
One for the purists,
because after this short break, we really need to delve into what I thought was one of the best afternoons of racing I've watched for a very long time, the team time trial.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by Indeed Sponsored Jobs. In a few weeks' time, all of the teams heading for the Tour de France will be selecting their lineups, sorting through their rosters to pick the best possible team for the race. And then their thoughts will turn to the transfer market. They might be in the market for a new sprinter or a new climber. Well, perhaps you're in charge of recruitment for your company. And if you are, Indeed Sponsored Jobs is all you need. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. Give your vacancy the best chance to be seen by the best candidates at Indeed Sponsored Jobs, because that will boost your job post to attract the best quality candidates so you can reach out to the right people, drawing up a short list of those that you want to interview, people who tick all of your boxes, and then you can recruit the right person to slot seamlessly into your team. Join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent sifting through the applications, and better results now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And because you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you'll get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves. Just go to Indeed.com/cycle and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the Cycling Podcast. That's Indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed.
So, Lionel, I never thought I would see you and I so animated and so excited about a team time trial, a 28.4 kilometre team time trial. But this new format, they've been trialling it at Paris-Nice for the past four editions of the race. So it's sort of well embedded. And, you know, I think we've all got our head around it by now. But the team time is taken on the first rider across the line, with each rider then being given their own time on GC. So in effect, what you've got is every man for himself. However, you have to work as a team if you want to do well. And I think we can all agree, as yesterday proved, that this is a much better way of doing things than the old team time trial format. I'm so excited. I'm falling over my words.
Absolutely. I mean, this really felt like the day when this particular format as a sort of jigsaw puzzle fell into place and you could see the potential for the format. All afternoon, the phrase that our dear friend Francois Thomas always says, which is that cycling is a team sport practiced by individuals, or an individual sport practiced by teams. And this was the absolute purest example of that. I always felt that I like as a spectacle, the team time trial. It looks beautiful, you know, the aesthetics of it, the sort of uniformity and the precision of the way they ride, you know, everybody, you know, on the same page, looks fantastic. Until it doesn't, and then a team falls apart. And I always felt the old team time trial format kind of punished weakness more than it rewarded strategy and strength. And I think this does the opposite. This is about how do we get our main guy round the course as quickly as possible using the strength of all the other guys. And I think we saw enough variation from the different teams to suggest that that opening stage at the Tour de France in Barcelona, when it will be the same format, is going to be absolutely gripping. You cannot take your eyes off it. You have to watch all of it, because you see for a moment, oh, they've lost a rider. They're down to four already with 12K to go or 16K to go or whatever. You know, there was something happening all of the time. And it was quite demanding, I think, for the viewer, because you were trying to process all of this information at once. And I wondered sometimes whether the intermediate time checks helped or hindered that understanding of what was going on. There were times when it helped and times when it kind of just confused matters. But the clarity of seeing the teams send their one or two riders, or in some cases start off at the bottom of that final climb with three or four riders, it really brought home the way the teams have thought about the best way to approach this particular challenge. And it was a great watch. Whether kind of newer fans of cycling would have had a clue what was going on, I'm not sure, because it took a little bit of getting your head round. But this was a much more dynamic and exciting version than any of the ones we've seen at Paris-Nice. And I think it's because of the proximity to the Tour de France has focused everybody's minds. There's an absolutely brilliant opportunity to gain some pretty big time when it comes to Barcelona on the opening day of the Tour, as this format has proved.
I think the other thing that really added to it was that little detail of the course, that last climb to the finish, that last 800 metre rise at 6.4%, because it was just enough, particularly after you've been gunning it for the last 27 or so kilometres, it was just enough to really make a difference and really mean that you had to work at it tactically to deliver your GC leader to the bottom of that climb in good shape. But you also had to have, as GC man, you also had to have something left in the tank to be able to tackle it and tackle it well. I was going to go back and just clarify that previously with team time trials, what we used to see was the team's time, everyone got the same time, it was taken on the fourth man across the line. But then it was so strange seeing one rider at a time, or riders in ones and twos, cross the line at the top of that little rise to the finish.
Yeah, it was. But I think also when you know that the star riders are not being quite as penalised, I felt that taking the time on your fourth rider, effectively the middle man in the team, it gave some tactical flexibility. You could afford to shed one or two early. You could use up your big diesel time trial specialist in however way you saw fit. But the GC riders were always kind of hampered a little by the fact that their time would be taken on the fourth rider across the line. This gives the GC riders the opportunity to, you know, sit in the wheels a bit and then really press home the advantage. And for that last kind of couple of minutes up the climb, it was almost like an individual time trial within a team time trial. I think as a spectacle, it was just fantastic to watch. And, you know, the drama built over the course of a couple of hours, it was the perfect length as well. You could just about maintain that level of concentration for a couple of hours. And it was just the intrigue of seeing, well, the first team, Picnic Post NL, they're having a shocker of a season. You know, they're not scoring any points anywhere. They've won only one race. They haven't won a World Tour race. They're not doing well. What are they going to look like coming over the line? And then just to see one lonely Picnic Post NL rider come up to the front and set the best time, which obviously wasn't going to stand for too long, should give him a name check. It was Robbie Dahont. Yeah. It was unusual. It was like, my brain initially said, oh, blimey, they've had a shocker. But then, no, of course they haven't. This is how they're
exactly
going to ride.
I did exactly the same thing.
This is how they're going to ride it. And so then Lotto Antomarche were the next team to finish, and they were quicker by about 2.5 seconds. And then NSN, who were starting at a big disadvantage because they were already down to five riders, they were the next to finish, and they had the green jersey. Riseberg, the green jersey wearer, leading out George Bennett to sort of sprint up the hill. And that was when it clicked for me that I thought, there's going to be some GC riders who are really going to, you know, not necessarily gain lots of time, but this race within a race within a race is going to be really quite gripping to watch.
Exactly that. That's that's when it clicked that, okay, well, this really does have a proper bearing for individuals in the big picture, in the big GC picture.
Mm. Jayco and Lula absolutely streaked round, didn't they? They were the first team to set a serious marker. They were 1 minute 47 quicker when they got to the finish. So blew NSN's team time out of the water. And then we saw both Bahrain Victorious and UAE Team Emirates come close, but not topple Jayco and Lula. Bahrain were just 11 seconds slower. Their last three riders were Van Mechelen and then Buitrago and Bilbao. And Buitrago was the last man. And we saw Bilbao kind of lead down into the corner and get out of the way so that Buitrago could really get as much of a sort of slingshot up the hill to get going.
That looked to me like they had really focused on that little bit of detail going into that last climb, because you saw Bilbao almost ride himself into the barrier for Buitrago and almost come to a standstill, and then almost sort of have to do the kind of Austin Powers turn in the tightest of the tightest of scenarios to be able to stay up on his bike and almost, you know, turn at right angles to be able to tackle the climb. But he gave Buitrago a sort of superb slingshot out of there. But I thought that spoke to the fact that Bahrain Victorious had really paid attention to, okay, well, how are we going to set our main man up for that last ramp here? Those little details were really interesting, and they were sort of scattered throughout as well, and they kind of built into this really lovely, rich narrative that just made it an enthralling day from start to finish.
It did, yeah. I mean, UAE Team Emirates were even closer to Jayco's time. Isaac Del Toro was their last man, and they were just 7 seconds slower.
And then Jayco were a really good benchmark as well, because I was looking back at the four editions of Paris-Nice that this sort of format of time trial. I mean, Jayco, in their history, they've been a very good team time trial team, but they've podiumed in three out of the four team time trials of this format in Paris-Nice. So they were a really good benchmark to start with.
Yeah, especially as they didn't have like a GC type rider. I mean, Luke Plapp's a good climber, isn't he? But it was Michael Matthews who was actually the first over the line, Plapp just off his wheel. But they were a real sort of team time trial effort. I mean, Luke Durbridge is kind of the metronome at the heart of any team time trial effort, isn't he? And I think that was what was that really put into perspective the fact that the teams would have to match the best team time trialists over the team time trial bit of the course, and then have a climber who could finish it off. And I think that's where I was really impressed by Movistar. I mean, they only beat Jayco and Lula's time by just under 2.5 seconds, but they got into the bottom of the climb well. They were a man short as well, because Diego Pescador didn't start the stage. They propelled Kian Uytdebroeks into the that final corner, and up he went. And I mean, he gave it absolutely everything. I mean, we're still waiting for Uytdebroeks to really kind of step up to the level where we're sort of expecting him to reach. You know, a former Tour de l'Avenir winner, turned pro very young, and has had a couple of false starts, hasn't he, with teams. Left Bora Hansgrohe after a couple of years, left Visma Lisa Bike after a couple of years, and maybe he's found a place at Movistar where he can kind of ride as a sort of, you know, he's not expected to kind of fit in with I mean, Movistar's kind of team culture is a collection of individuals in a way, isn't it, anyway? But on this occasion, they put together a really solid team effort, and he finished it off very well.
And they clearly worked themselves into the ground for him, 53 seconds ahead of his nearest teammate, Uytdebroeks finished.
Yeah. So,
I mean, but that looked like, for a little while, it looked like that might be enough.
I wasn't sure. I didn't think that. I thought there would be stronger squads to come, and the next leaders were Lidl Trek, and they beat Movistar's time by just about 20 seconds, I think it was. And this was because not only are they a very good team time trial squad as well, but they also had Matthias Skelmoser absolutely bury himself for Juan Ayuso on the final climb. I mean, the pair of them were locked together up that climb and really working very hard. And they clearly had a plan and they executed it really well.
Almost a novelty at that point to see two riders cross the line together as well, just to freshen things up a little bit over the course of the day.
Yeah, it was. And when you talk about the sort of time gaps, you know, they obviously used Julian Bernard, Lena Kemner, Quinn Simmons, Carlos Verona, Tom Schuins was the sort of the last one with them. But, you know, they were losing, you know, over 2 and in some cases 5 minutes over the remainder of the course. So they obviously rode it in stages. Difficult to tell because you don't see every team's full effort, do you? But you could sort of tell from the results and the way that they came into that final phase that, right, they must have treated this almost as a sort of two-half. Let's burn through a couple of riders and really use them to great effect in the first half of the course, and then cut them loose and go on with the remainder.
Who have we got next?
Well, next came the really interesting one, Decathlon, because we're all waiting to see what Paul Seixas would do. Remember at Paris-Nice, Paul Seixas wasn't there. This was, in fact, the first team time trial of his career as a pro, so a new experience for him. But if you remember at Paris-Nice, Dan Hooler kind of was off the front. He'd blown his team up a bit, hadn't he? And it was all we couldn't work out at the time, was that a plan, you know, to try something different with Hooler to try and get the time on his own, or had he just gone too hard and blown the team up?
Looked like he'd learned his lesson.
Very much so. They were really well drilled, weren't they? And all the teams had thought about what order and where they would put their riders in the rotation. But, you know, they were keeping Seixas, you know, almost sort of bodyguarded by Dan Hooler, weren't they? And there was a little moment, wasn't there, when
there waving his arm in the air, sort of saying, guys, this is too much. You're giving it too many beans here.
I think it was directly
at
Seixas that. Yeah, just calm down. Not necessarily you're going too hard for us, but just you're maybe going too hard for you. You need to just save enough. Your bit is at the end on the climb. We're here to do this bit for you. And there was a heart-stopping moment. You talk about the key point on the course, that sharp bend at the bottom of the hill. Heart in mouth moment when his back wheel slipped as he went round the corner, as Bissio kind of pulled off to give him the best line round the corner. Seixas's back wheel skipped and jumped. He held it up, but that was a moment, wasn't it?
It looked like he just put the power down a little bit too early, almost a little bit too keen. Didn't necessarily take Dan Hooler's words to heart in the same way that he might have, or didn't register in the same way that they perhaps could have done. But he got away with it. I was really impressed and sort of raised an eyebrow. You see the L'Equipe reported quotes from Seixas afterwards. He talked about how he'd gone into the team bus. So they asked him what he said when he walked into the team bus. So back to Paul Seixas. It's almost an episode about Paul Seixas getting on the team bus. So he said, look, I told my teammates that this kind of day can happen. It's not that serious, and we are going to get back in the game. It's not like we've lost 3 minutes. You have to keep your head high and move onwards as best you can. So in the end, he's lost a minute. So it's not the end of the world, given the mountainous weekend that we've got ahead of us. So he refused to sort of categorize this as a major setback, given that he wasn't too far off riders like Ayuso and Del Toro. And we'll get to the time taken by the other GC contenders in a minute. But he said, look, it's not ideal. It's not definitive. But he was talking like he's 19 years old and he's got the confidence to address his team as their leader and sort of rally them in a way that totally goes against the experience that we know he has, or that we know he doesn't have. And, you know, get your catchphrase bell ready. But does that remind you of Bernardino or what? sort of.
Well, let's
very,
not get
very,
too
young.
Carried away here.
Very,
Graham.
Very
let's
young,
not.
And giving it the giving it the. I'm the boss. I'm the leader. Quite happily and with such confidence.
Yeah, well, Decathlon, I mean, they missed the best time at that point was Little Trek. They missed that by 13 seconds, but it was a good ride, although we were already aware at this stage that a couple of teams were streaking around the course behind them. The next team to come in was Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Now, of course, they're not here with Florian Lipovits or Remco Evenepoel, so it's I don't want to say a B team, but it's not the Tour de France A squad. They're going to integrate two, you know, world-class riders into their lineup. I thought it was interesting that they took four men into the bottom of the final climb, and perhaps that was what helped them to get the second best time at that point. But just coming up behind them, Net Company Ineos were setting the best time at the checkpoints until they had a bit of a wobble, didn't they? Because Oscar Onley dropped his chain. There was a moment where he's dropped to the back of the line, he put his arm up, he was fiddling around with his chain, he was off the back, and then we saw his teammate Kevin Vauclain kind of, you know, doing a Gallic shrug and an arm wave as to say, well, look, we've got to go on, we can't wait for Onley. But they did slow down and wait for Onley. Josh Tarling then paced him back up, and then the final three riders going into the bottom were Onley, Vauclain and Carlos Rodriguez, who got did his turn and got dropped, and then Onley and Vauclain rode to the top with Vauclain first to the line, and they absolutely smashed it. I mean, nearly 23 seconds faster than Little Trek at that point, and they looked like they were going to win the stage and potentially put Vauclain into the yellow jersey.
And that speaks to his annoyance, doesn't it? Because he could see, you know, yellow was in his sights at that point, and he obviously knew how well they were going. They won the time trial at Paris-Nice this year, and I think he had a similar experience. He didn't quite get yellow there, so it's sort of Groundhog Day for Kevin Vauclain all over again. But he was, yeah, I mean, the fact that his... the fact that he was so annoyed tells you, one, that Ineos are really competitive, but it does make you sort of wonder about their two-pronged attack. And that's clearly what they've gone out with and clearly what they're sticking to. But he said afterwards, didn't he, I don't think that would have been my strategy, when he was asked about whether or not they should have waited for Oscar Onley. But he said, look, you know, it's a bit complicated. It's a very delicate situation because we're traveling at 80 kilometers an hour. If you wait for someone, whether they are considered strong or not, you lose a huge amount of time. And you've got to think that the way things ended up with them only 9 seconds back, that if things had gone to plan for them, and if Onley hadn't have dropped his chain, then that could have been a very good day for them indeed. And you probably would have an Ineos rider, whether it would have been Vauclain or Onley, in the leader's jersey.
Yeah, I mean, Vauclain's obviously not going to take that as the strategy, not the optimum strategy for him, is it? But
I don't think that was their optimum PR strategy afterwards either.
Well, I mean, what would we prefer, for him to button it up or for him to make his opinion known? I mean, nothing wrong with that, but you know, he's no longer a French leader of a French team, is he? He's a French leader of a British badge team, which has a British GC rider who finished within a sort of stone's throw of the podium at the Tour de France last year. So, you know, the pecking order was made pretty much clear. But even if it was kind of, look, your joint leaders, do you leave Oscar Onley behind? I don't think you do. I think you have to ease up and keep both riders in the game for as long as possible, because they are now both fully in the game for the mountainous stages that come. And it wasn't a perfect ride for Net Company Ineos anyway. You know, Sam Watson had a problem early on and was dropped. He would have been very useful on that sort of middle phase, the flatter middle phase. So the fact that they put together such a solid... And at that point, a very, very good time bodes well for them. But you know, next up was Visma Lisa bike, and considering Wout van Aert was kind of riding on, you know, one leg and was dropped in the first 9 or 10 kilometres, the fact that Jonas Vingegaard is not there, I thought this was an extraordinary ride for them. Bruno Armourie, of course, the French time trial champion, did the ride of two men. I mean, he rode so strongly on the flat, he took them into the bottom of the climb. Nordhagen then took over, and then Matteo Jorgensen. He sprinted up there as if the entire frustration of that crash at Amstel Gold had been building up over the last 6 weeks. And, yeah, he had time in hand, didn't he? He did enough to win the stage by almost 10 seconds for Visma Lisa Bike and put himself right in the mix for the overall at this week's race. Because we knew by this stage that EF Education, Easy Post, although they were doing a really good ride, it wasn't going to be enough to win the stage. But the big question was, would it be enough to keep Alex Baudin in yellow? And the answer to that was yes. I thought they rode such a good race, considering they'd had to kind of ride on the front of the peloton for 234 kilometres the previous day. Mm. So they would have had soft, spongy legs for what was, you know, a perfect mix of speed, discipline, endurance, you know, the real sweet spot. That effort, isn't it? This sort of 30, yeah. 32, 33 minutes. It's athletically, it's that point where it's no long, it's not a short effort anymore, but it's not just a diesel effort. It's right in the middle.
It still plays to that team's strengths, though. I think that those if you look at those riders as an individual as well, it plays to their various strengths. Ben Tulett for Visma Lisa Bike was their best placed rider overall. Before yesterday's time trial, and he had a flat tyre, sort of skidded out, and it looked like at that point it could be a very bad day for Visma Lisa Bike, but it turned into a very good one with Jorgensen, as you say, with his sort of Spaceballs style time trial helmet, which it I know all the teams got very similar helmets, but when you're wearing all black like that, I can't help but think of the famous Star Wars spoof. Anyway,
I think they all look terrible. Yeah, absolutely terrible.
Not there for the aesthetics, obviously.
No, I really think this is a problem. You know, the sport has to look cool for people, and they're prioritising, you know, pesky aerodynamics. I mean, get your priorities right, guys.
Yeah, quite right. on such an exciting day. Isaac Del Toro won't be best pleased with the UAE's performance yesterday. He's lost a bit of time overall.
Well, I was going to just run down the kind of the riders who are left in the GC, because it really is down to probably a sort of, you know, a dozen of them at most. But Del Toro is sort of, in inverted commas, last on GC. I mean, just to mention, for Santiago Buitrago, who's 18th overall, he was unofficial timing here, but I think he was fastest on that final 900 meter climb by a couple of seconds for Bahrain Victorious. He's probably a bit too far back at 121, bearing in mind you've got to trim a few seconds off, because Baudin, I don't anticipate staying there when they get into the bigger climbs towards the end of the week. But yeah, Del Toro is 16th overall. Then we've got Ute de Broeks of Movistar is 15th overall. Paul Seksas is 12th. I probably hope to be a bit closer than that, but very much in the mix and clearly going well, because I think his unofficial time on the climb was third best.
And a minute behind overall is, at this stage, absolutely salvageable, more than salvageable.
Of course, and when you've got to knock 12 seconds off that for Vauclin and Onley anyway, haven't you? So, then into the top 10, Carlos Rodriguez is one of three Net Company Ineos riders in there. Then we've got Bruno Armirai, who's one of three Visma Lisa Bike riders. Don't get carried away. Maxime Van Hills, Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, is in eighth. Nord Hagen of Visma Lisa Bike, seventh. Then come Skelmoser and Ayuso, and they're just 32 seconds behind Jorgensen overall, the Little Trek pair. Skelmoser, of course, on stage two, he had a crash in the final 3 kilometres and came in a couple of minutes behind all of the other GC riders, but of course was given the same time as everybody else. So he and Ayuso is a handy pair in the top six for Little Trek. Then comes Matteo Jorgensen in fourth. Onley and Vauclin, the Net Company Ineos riders, who are in pole position to inherit the yellow jersey when Alex Baudin falters, if indeed he does, in perhaps a couple of days' time, but we shall wait and see. It's beautifully poised, and I think the time trial stage, the team time trial stage, really has set it up for a fantastic second half of the race.
Absolutely. So at this point, do we want to put a placeholder in and say, you know, stop press, watch this space. We will come back with the result of stage four, because the riders will be rolling out from Puy-en-Velay very, very shortly.
We will. And I mean, I never thought we'd talk for 25 minutes about a team time trial.
And could have gone more. Cycling, could have gone longer.
Cycling is broken.
Yeah.
A quick stop press just to bring you bang up to date with the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. Stage 4 from Le Puy-en-Velay to Montrond-les-Bains, 167 kilometres, and another absolutely barnstorming race. Very entertaining from start to finish, and a day when the breakaway held on to contest the finish, thwarting the bunch. Helped, no doubt, by the fact that there aren't too many notable sprinters in the field, perhaps only Brian Coquart and Phil Bauhaus, and Wout van Aert for Team Visma-Lisabike. And it was Visma-Lisabike who were doing a lot of the chasing in the latter stages to bring it back together, but they didn't quite close the gap. The 10-man break, which had been away since the early kilometres of the stage, were able to contest the finish, even though it was very close. They went into the final kilometre, the gap was closing, but they held on to contest the finish, and it was a good clean sprint between them. And it was the American champion in the Stars and Stripes, Quinn Simmons of Lidl Trek, who won the stage, narrowly beating Finn Fisher-Black of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. Simmons won a stage of the Tour de Suisse last year. He's now added a stage of the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes. And surely the next thing on his list will be a stage at the Tour de France in a few weeks' time. Tuning up nicely for that. Overall, not too much change, but a couple of riders did tumble out of the top 10. Bruno Armirive fell from 9th down to 16th as a result of all the work he did for Visma-Lisabike trying to close the gap. And 37 places lost by Maxim Van Hills of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, who slipped down from 8th place overall. We'll perhaps delve into that a bit more deeply next week when we return to discuss the second half of the race, and that episode will be out early next week.
So Lionel, we mentioned the possibility of a podcast for the purists earlier. For anyone not sure of the rules, clarification corner.
Clarifications corner. Yeah, well, there's been a fair bit of news on the rules, some of which we've touched on in recent weeks and months, but some of which is newish. And because of the yellow card for Anton Charmig, I thought just run through a few of the things that have been announced lately. That yellow card for Anton Charmig, people asked, you know, why wasn't he disqualified? And well, one of the reasons was because the yellow card system operates at World Tour and Pro Series level. A bit further down, there's no yellow card system, and so riders who are warned and by the commissaires are liable to be disqualified on the spot. And there's a rider, Dutch rider, Jan Willem van Schip, who has got a bit of a reputation for this over the last few years. He's been disqualified from a number of races for either bending the rules with regard to permitted equipment. He's ridden with his the brake hoods ridiculously bent in to basically circumvent the rules and have a more aero position. He got disqualified from the Heist Appeal in 2024. He got disqualified from the Tour of Holland last year, and he's been disqualified from a couple of races in quick succession, the Tour of Hellas last month, and just in the last few days the Ronde de l'Oise in France. And well, this occasion was because he got in the brake and put a bidon down the front of his jersey, and he's saying, well, I was just holding my bidon there. But the suspicion is that riders are doing it to change their frontal area and make themselves a bit more aerodynamic. And he was warned by the commissaires and eventually kicked out. So, you know, he's been warned several times. and disqualified a few times. And I think, you know, there's maybe a sort of a sense that there's sort of some kind of two-tier justice here, but I'm not necessarily sure that's the case here. But there are a few things that have been unveiled by the UCI recently. And one is that pockets on the front of jerseys will be banned from July the 1st this year, so in a couple of weeks' time. And that is primarily to avoid riders altering the shape of their bodies. They are allowing a pocket intended for a radio, which I think is curious, because if you've got a hard object like a radio tucked in the front of your jersey and you crash, and you crash on your front, I would have thought that would increase the chance of, you know, fracturing ribs or what have you. Whereas if they're in a pocket on the back, it's less likely that riders crash and kind of land on their back hard. Well, they might land on their front hard. Anyway, you can't put anything.
Well, yeah, the
in
radio
front
is the thing that's going to do the damage, isn't it? And it's changing your aerodynamic shape.
Yeah.
It's kind of by the by. And a bottle, okay, yeah. You know, it's not going to do you any good, but it's the radio is the thing. So again, it does seem like there are a couple of contradictions in there. Who knew? Contradictions from rules handed out by the UCI.
Well, yeah, I mean, another one that's coming along is that they're banning bends in the final 200 metres of sprint stages. Now, there were a couple of comments made about a couple of the Giro stages, a big U-bend, almost like going around the sort of bottom of the toilet in Napoli. It wasn't helped by the fact that it was wet and it was on cobbles, but that was quite an extraordinary finish. Now, that would still be allowed because it wasn't within the last 200 metres. But there have been some finishes in other races where little kinks in the road or bends have come too close to the finish. So the UCI is going to be hotter on that. They're also
We agree with this one, don't we?
I think it's
rules necessary to sort of save the riders from themselves.
I think that's exactly right, Graham, because, you know, on the one hand, you can say, well, look, everyone knows what the route is. They know that, you know, there's a ridiculous U-bend on wet cobbles, to take it easy. But this is their livelihood, and it's a, for want of a better phrase, it's a dog-eat-dog business, isn't it?
Who is going to take the chance, who's going to be boldest.
Exactly.
Victory belongs to the boldest.
Exactly. And so I think the UCI does have a responsibility to save the riders from themselves in a sense, and just make sure that the finishes don't push the riders beyond acceptable limits and lead to unacceptable risks. So that's a good decision. There's a rule coming down the track to limit the size of bike computers on riders' handlebars. This one is a couple of years away, but from January the 1st, 2028, the maximum size will be 126 millimetres by 71 millimetres. Now, my cycle computers all conform, so I'm okay. I'll still be able to race in the Tour de France, Graham.
I've got your iPad strapped on the front of your handlebars there.
Yeah, and I think almost all of the current models conform to this size, but I think this is a kind of a preventative one. The UCI perhaps learning from history that they can't retrospectively legislate and say, once somebody's developed a piece of equipment, they can't then say, oh, that's too big, we're going to make the limit smaller. So they're looking ahead and placing a limit. So everybody knows in good time that you can't have, like you say, the equivalent of an iPad on the handlebars. Because again, it's one of these things that somebody will keep pushing and pushing and pushing as riders want more and more data at their fingertips during racing. I mean, let's face it, they've got heart rate, they've got body temperature, they've got the speed, they've got the distance, they've got the profile of the course, they've got all of this information. Glucose and lactate measurements are still banned, but yeah, it's a tricky one, this, isn't it? Do you need a bigger screen so that the data is more legible if they're going to access this data anyway, or do you have a smaller screen so that practically they can't display too much data? It's not great practice to have everyone racing around, you know, inches away from each other, you know, pressing the screen, touch screen or buttons on the side to scroll through.
This is what Michael Woods was saying at the Tour de France last year in terms of safety, and particularly in wet conditions. And as you say, when you've got, you know, a full peloton of riders who are inches away from each other, what you don't want is them concentrating on a screen in front of them. And what you do want is them concentrating on the riders around them.
Yeah, and yet, you know, you talk to riders, and although they're not looking at the mapping, you know, they're glancing down split second to just just tell the memory, the mind, refresh the mind, you know, when the corners are coming up on descents or what have you. You know, they're not following them, you know, like a GPS system, but there is information that can help but also hinder. And I guess it's about trying to make that balance and ensure, again, save the riders from themselves, because if there's no limit to the screen size, you could imagine somebody coming along with, you know, a full fold-out laptop on the handlebars. And
we're a way away from that, but never say never. Go on, sorry.
But I think this preventative approach by the UCI is the result of a harsh lesson they've learned in this attempt to trial gear restrictions. They wanted to restrict gears to have a trial period, restricting gears to the equivalent of 54 by 10, which is a 10.46 metre per pedal stroke.
Mm.
Gear. Now, this was a proposal from the Safer Group, which is made up of ex-pros as well. So it's riders who know the peloton who've proposed this idea. But SRAM, the American bike components manufacturer, they weren't happy with this because it makes some of their equipment non-compliant. So they appealed to the Belgian Competition Authority. And, you know, they don't want their equipment to be non-compliant because it's available on the market. And it's important that they're selling stuff that is used in the World Tour. SRAM have argued that high gear ratios on their own do not increase the risk of crashes. The UCI has been defeated on this one a couple of times, but is planning to try and push through with it again. I think this sets a really tricky precedent, because who's responsible for setting the rules of the sport? Is it a governing body which is linked to the IOC, the Olympic organisers, which has wide responsibilities for making the sport fair and accessible? Or is it the private sector based on commerce? Like, somebody has to set the rules of the sport so that they're safe and they ensure fair competition. And I think if you looked across other sports, it's a bit like saying, well, should we let the pole vault manufacturers set the, you know, the rules for what is a permissible pole vault? Or should we allow the football boot manufacturers to come up with a design that and just say, well, that's now allowed? Or is that up to the governing body? I think this is a real far-reaching one that could have ramifications beyond cycling in the future. Somebody needs to kind of get a grip and say, no, look, the sports rules are set by the governing body, and maybe there needs to be a much better consultation period with other stakeholders, including equipment manufacturers.
The other thing, of course, that the rules do is expand the UCI's coffers when teams fall foul of them. Credit to Matilda Price, our colleague on Cycling News, for reporting that yesterday. Would you like to take a guess at how many Swiss francs the UCI pulled in yesterday, thanks to various teams going against or being penalised heavily for lateness of presenting their bikes for inspection before the time trial began?
I have no idea. You tell me.
10,000 was the number, and that's largely down to Jayco Alula, Total Energy, and Lotto Intermarché.
10,000 Swiss francs.
Yes.
Well, Graham, 10,000 Swiss francs is around 10,800 euros, which is around 12,500 US dollars, which is around 9,300 pounds. A reasonable amount of money in fines. Decent day's work for the UCI's referees there. But kind of a drop in the ocean, I guess. I mean, they put aside 300,000 euros, I believe, to fight this SRAM case in the first place. So yeah, well, maybe the teams are being fined to mount the defense costs or cover the defense costs for the UCI when it comes to defending their rules. It's a wacky situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, you get days like this occasionally too, but I just thought that was a number worthy of mention. So before we wrap up, anything else we need to look out for between now and next week, with the exception of our wrap of stage four coming later?
No, well, it's into the mountains, isn't it, over the back half of the week and the weekend. We'll know by Sunday night who the winner of the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes is, we might have to take the Paul Sexas hypometer down a degree or two, depending on how he does.
Might have to take it up a degree or two when he wins. He goes clear on GC by 2 minutes.
Indeed. But we'll be back early next week to recap the rest of the race and unpick how exactly it played out.
All right. Well, looking forward to that. See you then.
Have a good week, Graham.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Burney.
We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.